Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, being really hung up on material possessions may be a sign of insecurity. We'll spend this hour with Francine Russo, whose article in this month's Scientific American explains how psychologists devised experiments to test the ways our emotional state can change the relationship we have toward our stuff, making people who feel vulnerable cling more tightly to their possessions. We'll talk about why it happens and when it starts to be a problem, as with the 4-5% of Americans who exhibit hoarding behaviors. Our conversation starts after a short break. You may have heard the term transitional object. It's a fancy way of describing an item that babies rely on for comfort when their parents are not physically present. You know, you put a little one to bed with her favorite blanket or stuffed animal, knowing it will help her settle down and fall asleep. Well, long after that lovey falls apart in the wash, it turns out we sometimes still use stuff to fill emotional needs. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Francine Russo is a journalist who often writes about psychology and human behavior. She's been tracking some fascinating research on the relationship between our emotional attachments to other people and the importance we assign to our possessions. She writes about this for the May issue of Scientific American in an article called Our Stuff, Ourselves. And she joins us from the studios of NPR in New York. Francine, welcome to Think.
Hello, Chris. Nice to be here.
So our favorite things stand in for people with whom we have secure relationships very early in life. How does that work exactly for babies?
For babies, some of the early psychoanalysts, early 20th century psychoanalysts like Bowlby and Ainsworth and Winnicott proposed that the kind of relationship babies have, infants, with their caregivers, usually their mothers, whether that determines the kinds of relationships we have with all the other people in our lives as we get older. So, for example, most of us are fortunate enough to have a caregiver or parent who takes care of our needs pretty reliably, feeds us when we're hungry, makes us comfortable and secure when we feel uncomfortable. Now, for people who have a less reliable caregiver, they tend to have an anxious attachment style to the people in their lives and be clingy and always wondering, you know, is that person going to be there for me? Now, the security object of a baby is something, as you said, that the baby knows that itself is separate from its mother, which doesn't happen right away. And then the baby knows that this little fluffy bear will be with me and represent mommy, and I can be by myself and be okay as long as I have the bear, which stands in for mommy.
What's so interesting about that is that it's always just like it's like one bear, right? Or one blanket. You can't, woe to the parent that says, just take your rabbit instead if the bear is the object.
Oh, my gosh, yes. For my daughter long ago, it was a pink pillow that had been carefully smocked by her grandmother. And she, even when she was 2.5, she carried it around the house and it fell apart. And at one point, it was just in tatters, and I asked her grandmother to make another one. And I substituted the new one, and she looked at it for a split second, and then she accepted it. It was pink pillow. She called it pink, and she just accepted it, and I just breathed a sigh of relief.
So we grow out of our need for a pink pillow or a stuffed bear or a security blanket, but scientists in Israel came up with this really clever experiment to demonstrate that how we feel about ourselves, at least in childhood, continues to shape how much we value our things.
This is true, and in fact, it had already been demonstrated in adults, which we will talk about later, but these Israeli social scientists wanted to see how ingrained this was. And in fact, they did some experiments where the fix was in. So a little boy or a little girl about 6 or 7 years old, maybe up to 9, would come into the classroom and they would play a computer game, very easy computer game. And how however they played, they lost one and they won one because the fix was in. The social scientist had arranged for this to happen. And by the way, they hastened to assure me that no children had been injured in the course of this experiment because the last game they played, all of them won. But they were asked to describe their favorite shirt or blouse or their favorite toy. So it might be typical, say, for a little boy to say, my favorite thing is my yellow shirt with the red dinosaur. I'm not wearing it now because my mama made me put it in the wash. But that's my favorite thing ever. And then the scientists would, after winning and after losing the game, would say, how would you be willing to lend this shirt for a night to some other child who would really like to have it, just for a night? And after the children were dramatically twice as often more willing to lend their shirt or their toy, might be a truck, lend their toy truck to another child after they had won the game than after they had lost. Their sense, when they had a strong sense of self, a strong sense of confidence, they felt more generous and they were willing to do that.
This made me think about the way we think about social programs. So often people who feel sort of threatened in their own lives are reluctant to support programs that they think might benefit someone else.
Huh, that's a very interesting way to look at it. I think certainly when people are feeling good about themselves, they feel more generous and able to give.
So a few years ago, a meta-analysis of a number of other studies concluded that fewer college students were securely attached, back to that term that we brought up earlier, in 2011 than in 1988. What could be the cause of that?
Well, the scientists don't really know the cause, but they speculate that, and they don't really mention causes, rather correlations. Mm-hmm. They see that people are less attached when they're more materialistic, for example. And in fact, people tend, some of the experiments that the social scientists did showed that when people feel less secure, they become more attached to material objects, including ones that cost money. So it's really a question, what's the cause and what's the effect? There's a correlation there. And the same thing is true with narcissism, that if somebody is very focused on themselves, that may be because they have an insecure attachment, they can't count on other people, and they puff themselves up and aren't very giving to others.
I thought this was so interesting. Feelings of insecurity make us more dependent on our phones.
Well, we're dependent on our phones anyway. And those experimenters did a separate a preliminary study where they asked people, they probed exactly how much they viewed their phone as an important way of making social communication. And the answers to that were quite varied. But when they did this experiment, where I believe they asked people in a writing exercise to, social scientists call this priming. Before they ask what they really want to know, they ask people to focus on something that might make them feel either sad or bad or something. So that different groups were asked to write a few sentences about when somebody else had let them down. And they were in different groups depending on whether the person who let them down was a close friend or romantic partner, or whether the person who let them down was a stranger or just an acquaintance. And over again, the experimenters found that if they wrote about, in other words, they were asked to think about the possibility that maybe their boyfriend or girlfriend might not come through for them, they felt enough insecure at that moment that they wanted to get their cell phone back right away because they'd given up their cell phones. And then they were asked to write an open-ended essay. And the ones who felt less anxious, who had just written about a stranger letting them down, might sit there for another 20 minutes and write this essay and were perfectly fine waiting to get their phones back. But the ones who wrote about their best friend or their girlfriend letting them down, they quickly finished this in 5 minutes and they got their phone back.
So we're using our phones as comfort objects, potentially.
Oh, potentially, definitely.
All right, so you touch on the tendency that humans have to anthropomorphize inanimate objects. And this is about the way we assign human qualities to things that aren't human. Is that right?
Absolutely. And I think it's natural for everyone to do it. And examples, there was a really interesting quiz that one experimenter gave to people to find out how great was their tendency to anthropomorphize. And he would ask questions like, when your computer keeps stalling, do you think it's got it in for you? or when your alarm clock rolls off the table, every time it rings, do you think it's trying to help you get up? Did you ever name your car? You know, do you ever pat it on the hood when it gets you where it's going despite your fears? So we all have a tendency to do it to some extent. And people have, this interacts with our need for other people. Do you remember, if you saw the movie that Tom Hanks starred in called Castaway?
Sure, yeah.
He's alone on a desert island. There's no other human being. He's desperately lonely, and he paints a face on this volleyball that's washed up with him, and it becomes his best friend. He talks to it. He confides in it, and in a very dramatic moment, I can't remember whether he actually loses it or he does lose it, but he experiences the grief as if he's really lost a friend.
Right, like it washes out to sea and he thinks he'll never see this volleyball again.
Yes, exactly. Only it's not a volleyball to him, it's the face of his friend.
And it's really about the need that every human has to have relationships. So if they're not available in the real world, our brains will find a way to sort of fabricate them for us.
Our brains are our psyches, absolutely. Hmm. Yes. Some people have a greater tendency, just because of who they are, to anthropomorphize. And in some cases, if it's just a character trait, one experimenter found that the tendency to anthropomorphize could be a good thing. It could be like if you thought of your favorite thing when you were trying to take a risk, for example, like go out on stage and, you know, do your best. Then thinking of your favorite thing, which was like a friend, could help you do that. But in most cases, anthropomorphizing to a great degree happened with people who needed to fill a hole in their lives because there weren't enough people. So their things became the people in their lives.
Does this also explain maybe why it's easy for us to bond with pets, including pets that don't really give a lot back to us emotionally?
It certainly could be. There weren't any animal experiments that I looked at in these articles. But, you know, I think there have been a lot of experiments that show when we look at something that's perhaps a little foreign to us, we try to put it in a category of something we understand. Hmm. So if we see a strange kind of zebra, we say, oh, it's just like a horse with stripes. Or, you know, that mountain lion looks like that cat we used to have.
My guest is journalist Francine Russo. She covers psychology and human behavior, and she has an article in the May issue of Scientific American called Our Stuff, Ourselves. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or go to Twitter. We're @KERA Think. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with science journalist Francine Russo. Her article in the May issue of Scientific American is called Our Stuff, Ourselves. It's about our relationship to material objects and what that says about our relationships to human beings. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. These days, Francine, we are encouraged to talk to Siri and Alexa and Google, and those platforms will talk back to us, although there's not a brain there. There's just a computer trying to understand what we're saying. Does this mean that computers could someday really provide a kind of companionship to people who need it?
I think it could. The experimenter who said that those of us who have a tendency to anthropomorphize as a character trait can use our favorite object or thoughts of our favorite object as a secure base from which to take risks and to grow. And I think it's pretty clear just from everyday life that people more and more are talking to Alexa or whoever as if it were a real she and Alexa and have developed a relationship. So I think there is some possibility of emotional intelligence, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean, I meant, what's the word? For computer intelligence to help us develop, fill a role in our emotional lives.
So you said some people have a tendency, they're more likely than others to anthropomorphize as a character trait. So it's not always about us sort of feeling bad about ourselves or needing reassurance. Some people are just more likely to do this than others.
That's true. However, I think more often there's a negative side to this. I mean, we all tend to anthropomorphize a little bit. But people who have an anxious attachment style tend to do it more. And it is implicated in hoarding. But before we get to that, I just want to mention one experiment in which people were asked to rate the social qualities of a series of objects, like an alarm clock or a computer or a handbag. And then they were given one of these writing exercises, except instead of it being a negative exercise, like write about when your partner let you down, it was a positive exercise. Think about someone in your life you feel close to, that you trust, and visualize for a few minutes what it would be like to be with that person right now and write a few sentences about it. And then another group wrote about an acquaintance. The people who imagined being with somebody they cared about in a nice way were much, much less likely, dramatically less likely, to give the alarm clock and the computer and the handbag human qualities. And I think that's really interesting and indicates that, for the most part, a tendency to anthropomorphize a great deal is an indication of some human lack in your life or some human need or insecurity.
Something that's missing in our lives.
Something that's missing, yes, indeed.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Mary on the line in Dallas. Hi, Mary. Hi, Mary, are you with
Hello.
Us? Hi. Hi, go right ahead, please.
Hi there.
Hi, Mary.
I'm kind of really intrigued by your discussion today, so thank you for speaking. But I have kind of like, I just lost my mom about 8 weeks ago, and I had seven siblings. But it was just interesting that everyone knew that I had more of like this emotional attachment to her than the rest of my siblings, and I didn't know maybe what that probably stemmed from.
Well, I'm sorry for your loss. Is there anything about the kind of research and work that you've been doing, Francine, that might give Mary some clues?
Well, actually, are you attached? You were attached to your mom, or were you also more anxious to have certain of her belongings?
Yes. So, like right now, I have holding on to, of course, some valuable items, but some non-valuable items that just seems hard to part with. And I'm not sure why. I mean, it's like, anyway, it's just been kind of like, I know I don't need her walker. I'm going to make sure someone gets it. But at the same time, I put the stuff in the car and get it back out and then put it back in the car. And
yeah. I'm like, well, you know, Mary, this is, I didn't deal with this so much in this article, but I wrote a book about how siblings relate to each other over their aging parents. It's called They're Your Parents Too. And it's very, very common for each sibling to have, in a sense, a different mother, because each relationship is unique. If you were the oldest or the youngest or the one who was most like your mother, then you would have a whole different kind of relationship with her. And of course, especially in the aftermath of loss, we all have such a reluctance to let go of the things that were associated with that person we love. That's quite natural.
So some of these studies that you write about relate to the way that we extend our concept of ourselves to our things. We have this sense that objects become ours because we use them and interact with them.
Well, that's true. And I think for a long time, people have understood that what you are is more than just your body. William James, the late 19th, early 20th century philosopher and psychologist, said essentially we are everything that pertains to us, including our spouse and our children and our horses and our house and our yacht. He was obviously in a very high social class. But there's also a concept called contagion, that somehow the things that are ours are permeated with our essence. And the experiment that I really liked the best was done by the same Israeli researcher with children. And what he did was he asked them what would be their favorite toy or piece of clothing. And let's say it was a scarf. Probably my glitter shirt, said a little girl. Mm-hmm. And the little girl is shown a picture of another girl, her age, maybe 8 years old. And she said, this girl is very mean. She hits her friends. She doesn't listen to her parents. She doesn't listen to her teachers. And she's always yelling and hitting people. And then she's asked, would you lend your glitter shirt to this girl? And the answer is always, no, absolutely not. No, no, no. Well, what if we washed it? No. Well, what if we washed it, like, really a lot? Well, maybe. And so what is it that the child is thinking? And it's not just children who believe in contagion, that somehow her essence has become part of her glitter shirt. And that if you wash it enough, her essence won't go to this other girl and be touched by it. And I believe this was also a lending situation. She would get it back. And the question is whether this essence of herself could, it's like incredibly magical thinking, but this essence of herself could go to this bad person and then be touched by this person's badness and then come back to her. And, you know, adults believe in contagion in a different way, so that there were a lot of experiments, I think in the 1980s, that asked adults, would you be willing to wear a hat that belonged to a Nazi officer? Would you be willing to wear, would you like to have a shirt that belonged to Hitler? And in every case, the adults were filled with disgust. You know, not that, I'm sure it was clean and maybe it was new and whatever, but the idea that the bad person's self permeated whatever it was can come back to you. And the same is true, by the way, in a positive way. If you go to an auction where celebrity memorabilia is auctioned off, people will pay thousands of dollars for a shirt that was worn by a celebrity. And, you know, in some cases it seems crazy to me, because I remember going to the Baseball Hall of Fame And I'm not a baseball fan, and I was with people who were, and I looked at one display after another of what just looked like ratty old shirts to me, the shirt that Babe Ruth wore when he did this. And I thought it was crazy, but then I thought, well, if somebody gave me John Lennon's shirt, that would be okay. I'd pay for that.
Yeah, it is strange to think about that because it's just, like you say, it's just a shirt. It doesn't mean that you've met John Lennon.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Our number is 1-800-933-5372 if you'd like to join the conversation. I want to remind you that we are also on Twitter at KERA Think. Francine, what does any of this have to do, or what might it have to do with hoarding behavior, the inability really to let go of things that we don't have any real need for?
Think of it this way. We're all on a continuum in our terms of our relationship to our things. At the most benign level, the sentimental level, we want to keep, you know, things that are represent a particular moment or person, like Mary, who's wants to keep things that remind her of her mother. Or perhaps you went on a trip and you bought a Hawaiian necklace, or there's the first present that your husband or wife ever gave you. And these things are of sentimental importance. But then you move from the sentimental to the excessively attached to the really pathological. And it's all on a continuum. Now, people who become hoarders are at the very extreme end of that continuum. They tend to be people who have an anxious attachment style. So they anthropomorphize their possessions, and they use their possessions as comfort and build fortresses with them to keep them safe. They also feel that all of these objects, and we could be talking about piles of old newspapers and magazines that go all the way to the ceiling, they believe that somehow they're responsible for caring for these objects, that they're like curators. And they also feel that they would just be, these things are part of themselves, and they would feel tremendous grief at parting from them. And it's a very, very difficult situation for, and it's so extreme. There are therapies for it now, but to get serious cure for it can happen only in about 35% of the cases. It's very intense and very primal in its draw for people who are hoarders.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You write that hoarders might have intensified feelings on both sides of things. So maybe they get more of a high when they acquire something, and then it feels more painful, like more of a loss when they're forced to part with an object.
That's true. Their feelings are more extreme at either end. So let's say I love getting green bottles, mm-hmm. or just bottles. Because hoarders are not quite the same as collectors. But let's say I love bottles, and every time I get a new bottle, I just feel like I have won the jackpot. You know, I've won the lottery, and I have such pride and such a thrill. And it's huge. It wouldn't be like the average person getting, oh, that's a nice bottle. Actually, maybe I could use it for a vase. It's not like that. And at the other end, they feel just thinking about the idea or talking about the idea of throwing away or giving away or letting go of one of these bottles, they feel grief and loss and sorrow that so intense that they cannot let go of it. And we're talking about situations here. Sometimes hoarding can be keeping absolutely everything without any rhyme or reason, things that have no use, and yet create a hazard in your house so that you perhaps can't walk from one place to another. They create a fire trap. They attract vermin. And they also influence your relationships with other people in your life. And yet people still can't relinquish the objects.
Hoarding can feel like a really strange thing, but it's kept hidden so we don't realize how common it is. You note in the article that maybe 1 in 20 of us have a pathological inability to get rid of things we don't need.
Well, that's true, but there are degrees. Mm-hmm. So that I think, you know, many of us have some hoarding tendencies. Now, I confess, I lived in a big apartment before I moved to my current one when my kids were growing up. And I had gigantic closets, and every single one of them was filled with everything. And I had clothes that I had one closet full of clothes that I bought when, for a brief shining moment, I was a size 2.
You want to celebrate that by getting yourself a new wardrobe.
And I always believe that someday I would wear those clothes again. Mm-hmm. Well, needless to say, I did not, although I saved a few of my very favorite ones. And it turned out that my daughter was a perfect size 2 all her life. Hmm. And now she's actually wearing my 1970s vintage clothes. And her friends are saying, "Where did you get that?"
Oh, that's great. But that's not the same as hoarding, right?
Well, no, but if you can't get rid of something when you know you'll never use it again, that's a hoarding tendency.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you have just a lot of clutter and you don't go through your things because there might be something valuable in there that you might need someday, well, that's a hoarding tendency. And I think we all have them to some extent. There are very few people who live totally without clutter, and I admire them, but it ain't me, babe.
My guest is Francine Russo. She's a journalist who writes about psychology and human behavior, and she has an article in the May issue of Scientific American. It's called Our Stuff, Ourselves. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We're at @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with writer Francine Russo. Her article in the May issue of Scientific American is called Our Stuff, Ourselves. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Okay, Francine, I understand that hoarding tendencies fall on a spectrum. I wonder if the far end of the spectrum is people that we would define as extreme altruists, you know, the ones who live on almost nothing so that they can give everything away, the people who feel really tied down by owning objects.
I think that's the opposite extreme from a hoarder mm-hmm. because, you know, a hoarder might give away something, and some studies have shown that one way you can get a hoarder to give up a particular thing is to convince him or her that it's going to a good home, it's going to someone who will value it. But hoarders generally don't give up anything. They live with everything. At the other end of it are people who say, and I think this is extreme also, who say, "I don't need things, and everything I have, I am going to give away." And I can imagine this, you know, for somebody who is perhaps very wealthy and is giving away their money, their possessions because they don't need them, they have enough. But I think that if you think about people who have, you know, say, I don't need anything. I, you know, can just have everything I need in a backpack and I don't need another thing. And I think that's another extreme end. And I haven't seen studies on this, but I would guess that that might be the result of an attachment issue. Also, there are people who feel they're, as infants, that their caregivers pushed them away when they needed things, needed their needs met. And these people develop an avoidant attachment mechanism. And that's where they say, I can take care of all my needs by myself. I don't, they're emotionally distant from other people. And, you know, that sounds to me a little bit like that. But an altruist actually seems to be somebody who's very secure, feels I have everything I need, so I will give away these things to other people because they need them and I don't.
All right, back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Ardith in Plano. Hi, Ardith.
Hi, good afternoon. Chris, I'm calling about, as a child, I spent a lot of time moving. My dad was in the military. Our family stayed together and we moved a lot. And as a result, I was detached from friends on a very frequent basis. And so I did form a pretty strong attachment to many of my things, but I don't know that I anthropomorphized them, but I noticed that I needed many things, you know, to kind of maintain a comfort level for myself, not to the degree of hoarding. And then at the age of almost 50, I went through a divorce, oddly, as y'all were just talking about, I got rid of very nearly everything. Everything I've got now can fit in a van if I needed it to. And I've gone almost to the opposite extreme now where I don't want to add anything that might tie me down. But as a child, though, I found that those items were comforting, whereas, you know, friendships were very hard to sustain because I left everywhere.
That's really interesting. Thanks for your call.
That makes perfect sense to me also. I'd be really curious about how you are now.
Are people with hoarding tendencies helped by anti-anxiety medications? Does that cure the problem or fix the problem at all?
You know, I don't know that. I think that the only treatment that's been shown to be effective is cognitive behavioral therapy. You know, basically talk therapy in which people are led to examine their faulty assumptions about things and to develop a greater comfort level in being able to let go of those things. You know, one might think that anti-anxiety medication might be helpful, but, you know, it seems to me that that helps people's anxiety in the present moment. But these anxieties about not having people in your life or not having had enough of that when you were a child, I don't think that kind of thing might be helped by meds in the present, but I'm not a psychiatrist, so I can't tell you that for sure. One thing I want to mention is that our feelings about things are pretty primal in the sense that, you know, evolutionary psychologists look at this also, and they say that our things represent a survival mechanism. When, you know, we lived in a primitive state, if we lived in a place where food was scarce or food was seasonal, our lives depended on being able to store and save that food and have it for when we needed it. And the same thing was true for tools and shelter to keep us safe from tigers or warring tribes. So it comes out of a very normal life-affirming force that human beings need.
All right, back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Terry on the line in West Tawakoni. Hi, Terry.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Hi, I guess you just answered my question because I name almost all of my tools. I name my work van. But
are they your friends?
I kind of do it for fun. I mean, I enjoy it, you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, I could see that that could make your work more more comfortable. I assume you also have people in your life?
I have a wife and a son and two daughters.
Well, maybe you're one of these people for whom the tendency to anthropomorphize is just a character trait, and having your familiar comforting tools about you helps you grow, in your profession or in your hobby, whatever you're doing with them, and achieve greater things.
Is there a difference, as far as you know, Francine, in the way that our cultures operate in terms of, the U.S. is known to be a very individualistic culture. We pride ourselves, whether it's true or not, we pride ourselves on the idea that we are ruggedly independent. There are other cultures where we really pride ourselves on being part of a cohesive unit and really thinking about the needs of multiple people at the same time.
That's a very interesting question, and it's one that social scientists are just beginning to explore. So the Israeli researchers did some experiments with children in Israel and in Taiwan, because Taiwan is a much more collectivist culture than Israel, which is quite individualistic. And the experiment involved whether children would pick an item. They won a little prize in a game, and they got to pick stickers from a number of envelopes. And one of the stickers, one of the choices they had was to pick a red one, and let's say there were 10 red ones. And others might be, there was just one green one. The kids in Israel had a greater tendency at different ages to pick the one, to value something that was unique. And that was much less true in Taiwan.
Oh, that's so interesting. So the kids in Taiwan wanted to be like the other kids and have the red sticker.
Yes.
Huh. Yeah, I even think about the things that we give children as presents, and personalization is such a big thing now, right? You can order like a little beanbag chair with their name stitched on it, or a backpack, that sort of thing. I don't know if that's true everywhere, but it's almost like we're setting them up to really think about their things as belonging only to them.
That is correct. That is correct. And it is very, material objects are very, very important in the United States and in a lot of Western countries, where people display their objects as a source of self-advertising, if you will. And sometimes that is a substitution for actually feeling like you're terrific. And one classic experiment showed that MBA students, the ones who had the worst grades and the fewer job offers, tended to wear more expensive suits and more expensive watches.
So in other words, they want to signal that they're doing okay, whether or not that's true, and they use their possessions to do that.
They do, and it also makes them feel better about themselves.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's go back to the phones now. The number 1-800-933-5372. Alex is calling from Irving. Hi, Alex.
Hi, I'll make this really quick. Would you classify certain things that people would, under one definition, like my wife, hoarding, whereas I view it as collecting with specific regards like plants? You know, I'd love to have as many as I could, but I don't really view that in the same classification as, you know, having a bunch of clothes or having a bunch of cars, or, you know, because it seems that it's a little more substantive to human nature. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
There have been some studies of collectors, and it's true that hoarding has no rules. Everything is kept, regardless of whether it will ever be useful or whether it's falling apart. But collectors have rules. Now, and I think there can be a range of emotional health associated with collecting, so that, you know, a person could, I have a friend who was fortunate enough to be able to collect African art and to donate it to a museum. But there are other people who collect buttons. But somebody who collects thousands and thousands of buttons and has a pile of them in their yard, which the neighbors are complaining about, that person might be rather extreme.
So it's always a warning sign if any way of managing our things interferes with the very relationships that they may or may not represent.
Yes, correct.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you've ever watched those hoarding reality shows.
Actually, I have not. I'm much more of an Antiques Roadshow sort of person.
Yeah, I'm just curious because I think in some ways we all are looking for a sign that that we're doing okay, right? And by seeing someone whose behavior appears to us to be extreme, we're almost looking for comfort, that there's nothing wrong with us.
Well, you know, we're all on a continuum. So if our closets are so full that we have to put everything new that we buy or everything we get in piles, then we have a problem. Now, that may not be the same as being an extreme hoarder, but to the extent it interferes with our lives, it's a problem.
Did you get the sense from the research you did for this article that there are ways to set children on the right path with regard to a healthy relationship to things other than just making sure that they are securely attached to caregivers in infancy?
I don't think anyone I spoke with looked into that issue, but I would think, as in almost everything else about parenting, that our own relationship to things is far more important than what we specifically tell our children about their things. So that if they see us, you know, hoarding, you know, piling up objects after objects after objects, it hardly matters what we say to them. They will either see that as perhaps the way to be or develop an extreme aversion to that.
I know that you've written all kinds of things over the course of your career as a journalist. I wonder if a piece like this causes people to call you up or email you and sort of want to tell you their own stories about how they relate to their things.
Almost always. Yeah, people are very interested in looking at the experiments, and people are always saying, am I okay? And the answer is generally, sure, you're okay. You know, so if you have clutter in your closets that you can't get rid of, well, welcome to the party. But if your clutter is such that no one will come to your house and your boyfriend has left you, and you know, then you're not okay.
It's a sign that something needs a closer look, for sure.
Yes, yes, definitely.
Francine Russo is a journalist who often writes about psychology and human behavior. Her article in the May issue of Scientific American is called Our Stuff, Ourselves. Francine, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for making time for us.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure for me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think. Find the podcast using any podcast app you happen to like. You can also get a stream of the show at think.kera.org, and we have archives there dating back years if you want to check out old Think programs. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.